Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. Safe to say, most of us expect to be diagnosed, treated, and healed when we fall ill. Even when the diagnosis is serious, heart disease, perhaps cancer, there is hope. But what happens if an illness is exceedingly rare and there is no known treatment, or perhaps worse, no established network of researchers working tirelessly toward the discovery of a cure? David Fagenbaum's new memoir, Chasing My Cure, tells of the sobering reality of so-called orphan diseases. There are many illnesses about which the medical community knows very little, and which, because they are rare, attract minimal funding and scarce and scattered research. Fagenbaum knows this story firsthand. As a young medical student, he fell suddenly and desperately ill and was eventually diagnosed with idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease, an almost certain death sentence for a young man just starting out in life. Fagenbaum eventually led the charge to corral research into Castleman disease, and he tells us his story in his memoir, Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. And he is also an assistant professor of medicine at Penn. David Fagenbaum, so good to have you with us on Radio Times.
So glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to get the number out in case our listeners want to join us in the conversation. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. Or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works as well, @WHYYRadioTimes. So David, as a young man in college, you enjoyed incredible health. You are a Division I quarterback at Georgetown. Mm-hmm. Your friends nicknamed you the Beast.
That's right.
Tell us more.
I played college football at Georgetown and was a quarterback, worked out all the time, was kind of in perfect physical health. I don't feel like it's bragging to say how physically strong I was back then, because I'm not that strong these days.
What did you bench press?
I bench pressed about 400 pounds.
Okay. That's pretty strong.
Not close to that anymore.
And you were also blessed, or is it cursed, with an ability to hyper-focus?
I think that's probably the right way to put it, kind of a bit of a blessing and a curse. Ever since I was a child, I would lock into things and really couldn't think of anything other than that which I was focused on. Initially, it was my goal of playing college football, so I worked out all the time, I trained all the time to get me towards that goal, and then that goal has, and that focus has changed over the years.
Yeah. Well, and this gift of yours served you well as we go through the story, and we'll find out more in just a moment. But back to what was happening to you when you were in medical school at the University of Pennsylvania. You fell ill. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was totally healthy. And over the course of just a couple weeks, where I was actually in the hospital treating patients as a third-year medical student, I went from perfect health to having pretty severe fatigue, abdominal pain. I noticed fluid accumulating in my legs. It's kind of just strange symptoms. Yeah. Didn't know what it was and just kind of fought through the symptoms. One of the ways that I kind of dealt with it was that I would see patients in the hospital, go into a patient's room, and after I would come out of the room, I would find an empty hospital room and take a six-minute nap.
Hmm. 6 minutes exactly.
Yeah, I would set my alarm for 6 minutes. I was so exhausted that I would fall asleep immediately, and I would wake up 6 minutes later, and I would go see one more patient, and then I would take another 6 minute nap and see another patient, because that was the only way I could physically be vertical to get from room to room, would take these 6 minute naps. And I didn't know what it was. I knew that I was sick, but I didn't know what was making me so sick. And at that stage, there were symptoms that weren't that bad yet, but I knew something really bad was brewing. I had this kind of sense of doom. I even told friends that I thought I was dying when I was really just really tired. But unfortunately, over the next couple of weeks, the fatigue transitioned into much worse, into organ failure. Mm. My liver, my kidneys, my bone marrow all shut down. So after I took a medical school exam, I went down the hall to the emergency department, and they did blood work, and they told me that I was experiencing organ failure, and they had to hospitalize me right away. And once they hospitalized me, they moved me to the intensive care unit. Yeah. I had a retinal hemorrhage and went blind in my left eye. Hmm. I gained over 70 pounds of fluid and went in and out of consciousness, all with no diagnosis.
And all this time, the doctors couldn't tell you what was going on, and you were extraordinarily sick. What was going on in your mind?
So I was so sick, and because of all the organ failure, that my brain was pretty cloudy. So mm-hmm. I think that's probably a good thing. It was hard for me to have too complex of thoughts. But as I kept getting sicker and sicker, and the doctors didn't know what it was, at a certain point, the doctors encouraged my family and friends to say their goodbyes, because mm-hmm. they didn't think I would survive. Yeah. And though I was only awake for about an hour or so a day at the time. I do remember really vividly looking out my hospital window and thinking about my life and realizing that I didn't regret anything that I had done or anything that I had said. I only regretted the things that I hadn't done or had not said in my life, the people that I loved that I hadn't told that to, the things that I wouldn't, that I didn't do and that I would never have the opportunity to do, like have a family. And those were the things that really haunted me as I thought, and I prepared to pass away.
You were only how old?
I was 25 years old.
25 years old. And then after spending, was it 7 weeks in the ICU?
That's right.
All of a sudden you started to recover.
That's right.
And again, the doctors don't know why.
That's exactly right.
But you walk out of the ICU.
Walk out of the ICU after 7 weeks. I had been on high-dose corticosteroids, which can sometimes suppress an illness like it was doing in me, even though we didn't know what it was. And I got out of the hospital, but I certainly didn't feel confident that it wouldn't come back. I didn't know what it was, and I was concerned about what it could be. And so I spent the next few weeks poring through medical records. What was it? Trying to figure out what could this be so that we could be prepared if it came back. And unfortunately, before we could figure out what it was, it did come back four weeks later, and I was back in the intensive care unit. And it really came back with a vengeance, not responding at all to any corticosteroids. And I was getting very sick very quickly. In fact, the second time around, I was so sick, and the doctors didn't think I would survive, that my family had a priest come in and administer my last rites to me. So in November of 2010, at 25 years old, I had my last rites read to me and again said goodbye to my family. But fortunately, right around the time that I had my last rites read, they did the definitive test to diagnose idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease and start me on chemotherapy right away. And fortunately, the chemotherapy kicked in really just in time to save my life.
That is one of the treatments.
That's right. Chemotherapy at the time was really the only treatment.
Yeah, they thought it was perhaps a cross between something that was related to cancer and maybe something related to the immune system, and the chemo actually helped kick this back into remission for round two.
That's exactly right.
How rare is this?
About 5,000 patients are diagnosed each year in the U.S. with one form of Castleman disease or another. That makes it about as common as ALS. And of course, ALS is such a devastating disease, but is equally as rare but much more well-known. Castleman disease, the subtype that I have, a third of us will die within 5 years of diagnosis, and another third will die within 10 years of diagnosis. So it's rare, but it's a really devastating disease.
Let's talk about the immune system. You describe it as akin to a military force, and this is when it's operating normally.
That's right. Yeah, your immune system is supposed to be protecting you. It's supposed to be always on guard, ready for anything that could come at it to fight it off and put you back into a state of health. Your immune system fights off cancer, actually. It can also fight off, of course, infections, but it's there to protect you. It's supposed to be good. But unfortunately, sometimes that which is there to protect you can actually turn on itself, and that's what happens in Castleman disease.
You describe it as something to akin to what, friendly fire, but with nuclear bombs?
I think that's,
you do it better than I do, so why don't you make the description?
I think that's a good and a fair way to describe it, that it's the immune system is filled with these feedback mechanisms so that when one thing happens, it leads to another thing and another thing and another thing. So when the immune system is directed at itself, kind of so-called friendly fire, that friendly fire leads to more friendly fire and more friendly fire. So rather than kind of a misdirected shot ending things, the misdirected shot actually leads to, as you said, almost like a nuclear war on yourself, because there's so much immune activation and so much attack that occurs on your healthy vital organs.
So it's round two. You've almost died twice.
That's right.
And with round two, you're finally diagnosed with Castleman disease, and you do what physicians do not want their patients to do. You go to Google.
That's right. I finally had the diagnosis, and I went to Google, and it was actually the first time in the 11 weeks since I first got sick that I was by myself in the hospital room. Up until that point, my dad and my sisters had not left my side, but they happened to have just left the moment that the nurse walked in with the results, and she said, your doctor's out of town at a conference, but I got the results back, and the good news is that it's not lymphoma, and then she starts reading from the paper, idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease. And she says, I don't know what it is, but it's not lymphoma. Here you go. And so I was like, okay, you know, it's not lymphoma. I can be pleased about that. And then I Googled this disease, and I found out the really severe mortality rates in this, and kind of the scary side of this disease. Of course, I already knew how deadly it was from what I was going through, but mm-hmm. But I think seeing the numbers in front of me was really just devastating.
Yeah, and let's get back to the regrets that you just kind of alluded to a little bit earlier. At this point, you know, a lovely young woman had been in and out of your life.
That's right.
Caitlin.
That's right.
Safe to say you loved each other, and yet you were together on and off.
That's right. Yeah.
So, but at this point in your illness, you didn't want to bring her into the picture. Why?
That's right. So we had broken up about 6 months before I became mm-hmm. ill. And I remember after we broke up thinking to myself, if it's meant to work out, it'll work out. We have all the time in the world. And of course, all of a sudden when I became ill, I realized and I learned that I actually didn't have all the time in the world. And I realized that I shouldn't have just taken those last 6 months for granted, that if it'll work out, it'll work out. And so I really regretted that I hadn't fought for our relationship. I knew that we both wanted to ultimately be together, but it felt like I said, we had all the time in the world. And so I really regretted that I didn't fight for us. And as you said, with the first time I got sick, as I laid in the hospital bed regretting this, I made a decision that now I regret today. And that was that I asked my sisters to not let Caitlin see me when I was in the hospital room. And that really was motivated by the fact that I lost my mom to cancer while I was in college. And I was with her while she took her last breath. And I would never have done anything differently. And I have so many wonderful memories with my mom, but I do also have some of those really tough images
sure.
burned into my memory.
Sure.
And as I laid there and didn't expect that I would survive, I didn't want those final images to be Caitlin's final images of me. And so I asked my sister to not let her see me. And my sister had to tell her, you know, David doesn't want you to see him like this.
Painful.
So painful. Yeah. Caitlin describes it as the most difficult day of her life. And unfortunately, when it came back and I was back in the ICU, she actually traveled to North Carolina where I'd been transferred to. And again, I asked my sisters to not let her see me. So she had come down there and again, couldn't see me.
Well, describe what you felt you looked like at that point.
So at that time, I had over 70 pounds of fluid all over my body, mostly in my belly, but also in my legs. The beast of before, you know, this 230-pound football player, all of my muscle had been completely wasted away. In fact, that muscle maybe helped to save my life because my body was kind of destroying everything and had this flesh that could be consumed as part of my illness. And I had, I guess, more flesh because I had worked out so much. But I was really kind of skin and bones and fluid everywhere. And not that appearance is the most important thing in the world, but I just didn't want Caitlin to remember me that way. We had so many wonderful memories together.
We're going to continue that story in just a moment. We're up against a break and also talk about your relationship with your mom. And importantly, of course, your quest try to find a cure for Castleman's. Let me reintroduce you. David Feigenbaum is author of Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. He's also an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. If you'd like to join the conversation, lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In today for Marty Moskowain, David Feigenbaum is our guest this hour. He is here to talk about his memoir, Chasing My Cure, and how he used his medical training and crowdsourcing among patients and researchers to tackle Castleman's disease, which is very rare and which he had been diagnosed with, and it's a death sentence for many people. We are going to get more into how he managed to corral research into Castleman's in just a bit. But before the break, we were talking about the fact that you were deathly ill in the ICU. The love of your life, Caitlin, you did not want her to see you like this. You weren't together at the time. She wanted to see you. You told your sisters to tell her, no, David doesn't want to see you. It was very painful. So, David Feigenbaum, if you were to do this again, what would you do? You didn't look well. You didn't feel well. Would you have her come in?
I would have her come in.
Why?
Absolutely. I think that one of the main lessons I learned from my first near-death experience was that we need to make the most of the time that we're here and cannot live with any regrets. And that is a regret that I live with. So I absolutely would have had her come in and see me the way that I was.
Yeah. You spoke of your mother, too. You were very close to her. She died of brain cancer while you were in college. And in your book, you write that your family, after she was diagnosed, your family spent a year together with your mom, and eventually it became obvious that she would lose her battle. You write that your mom said it had been the best year ever, and that despite the chemo, cancer, and radiation, she was dying with joy. How does one manage to do that?
She was the most incredible person in the world. And just as was mentioned there, she lived and died so gracefully. And watching her and the way that she battled cancer and the way that she faced every day served as really a template or a model for me as I faced my terminal illness. In particular, one of the most important things I took away was this concept of, in the midst of tough times, creating silver linings. And a lot of times we say find a silver lining in the midst of a tough time, but she actually would create them. She would figure out ways, despite what I'm going through, let me create a silver lining, something to make positive out of something so difficult.
Mm-hmm. So throughout much of your battle with Castleman's, you were thinking, at least in the early stages, in the early days, someone out there has to know something about this. Let's talk about the hope and faith we tend to have in medical advances and what you call the Santa Claus theory of civilization. What is that?
Yeah, that's something that I subscribe to, and that's that I just assume there must be someone out there doing the right work at the right time for my disease, and that there must be groups of scientists studying this disease and looking for solutions. And I think we have that sense across our society that, you know, anything, any question we ask Google, we can find an answer. And we just assume that, you know, there must be work happening that we don't even see to produce those answers. But unfortunately, I learned that there are 7,000 rare diseases that affect 30 million Americans. So 1 in 10 Americans have a rare disease, yet 95% of rare diseases don't have a single FDA-approved therapy, nothing. So there isn't a workshop that has produced this treatment. There may be work being done, but it certainly has not produced the results that we need to date.
As you write in the book, the problem is that for some things, no one knows anything, nothing is being done to change that, and sometimes medicine is frankly wrong. So at one point, David, in your studies abroad at Oxford, you were introduced to the world of biomedical research, and you were shocked, this kind of goes to the point, that to find it was not a well-oiled machine in which the different fields, say cancer or cardiovascular research, et cetera, you know, were talking to each other. And as you put it, the chopped up terrain was basically futile.
Yeah, it was really shocking for me. I'm someone who had been wanting to be a doctor for so many years and really watching how wonderful the care was for my mom during her cancer battle. I just assumed that the research field was set up in a similar way, that people work together. You know, all of us have the dream and the mission of curing and treating diseases. So you'd think that there would be more collaboration. But I learned when I was at Oxford that unfortunately that's not the case. And really it's because the incentives are not necessarily in place.
Define orphan disease.
An orphan disease is any disease that affects less than 200,000 Americans. So it could be something that occurs in many people, but they die very quickly. So there's less prevalence, or it could be something that occurs much less frequently, but patients live longer.
Is Lou Gehrig's disease an orphan disease? You'd referenced it earlier.
It is. It's rare. Only 5,000 patients are diagnosed each year in the U.S. So it's about as common as Castleman disease. But we use the term orphan to describe rare diseases because these are diseases that are typically neglected.
Okay.
And Lou Gehrig disease, though it has public awareness, very few treatments exist for it. And I do still consider it to be a neglected disease because there just aren't enough solutions.
And yet it has caught the attention of Americans. There's the Ice Bucket Challenge.
That's right.
I think tens of millions of dollars hundreds of millions raised for research. Why do some illnesses grab the public attention as compared to others?
You know, I think that what I learned along my journey is that a lot of those sort of things seem to come down to kind of random chance, that the, you know, right researcher or the right patient, you know, stands up and fights against a disease, and that what I've tried to do in the research space is to try to get a little bit away from this kind of hoping that like the right researcher with the right background applies for the right project at the right time, to try to create some structure to get away from this kind of hoping and wishing that all of these things will line up.
Well, you found out during one of your bouts that you had five experiences, near-death experiences with Castleman's. You determined that your subtype of Castleman's, IMCD, received $0 in federal funding for research and treatment discovery. What was your reaction to that news?
So finding out there was no funding was shocking. What was even more shocking was to find out that the few researchers that were actually doing work had never spoken to one another before, had never shared results with one another, and that each of those researchers were kind of working independently on their own pet projects, but not necessarily the kind of work that was necessary to identify new treatments or cures for this disease.
What did you do next?
So this was right around my fourth flare when mm-hmm. I had now relapsed on the only drug in development for Castleman disease. This is the only option, and I had a conversation with my doctor and asked him, you know, what else is coming down the pipeline? What promising leads are there? And he explained to me, David, there are no more drugs coming down the pipeline. There are no more promising leads.
And tell us who this doctor
was. This is Dr. Fritz Van Rie. He's my doctor who's the world's expert on Castleman disease.
And so coming from the world's expert on Castleman disease, a lesser person, well, you know, or somebody perhaps more like myself, say, would have probably just wanted to crawl back under the covers and, you know, because it didn't seem as if there would be hope.
That's exactly right. For me, it was really rock bottom. And that was when I realized that what I'd been hoping for, treatments and cures, was not going to happen unless I turned my hope for a future into action. And I knew that I could no longer hope and pray that someone else somewhere, whether it was my doctor or someone else, would figure out this disease, because there had been no progress to date. And that if I wanted that to happen, if I wanted a future to be possible, I would need to turn my hope into action. And I promised my family, Caitlin and I had actually gotten back together at that time, Caitlin, my sisters, and my dad, who were in the room with me that day, that I would dedicate the rest of my life, however long that may be, to trying to identify treatments and cures for this disease.
And you turned to crowdsourcing.
That's right. I kind of saw it as two parallel approaches. The first was to build a community called the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, and to get away from this kind of hoping that the right researcher applies for the right project at the right time, to actually saying, let's figure out everyone who's ever treated or researched Castleman disease, and let's ask them what research questions need to be answered, who is the best researcher to do it, and what research studies should be done. And by using the crowd to identify what should be done, then we went out and we identified the best person in the world to do our prioritized study. So we get away from like hoping that the right person applies to saying what needs to be done. Let's go recruit them into our field to do the work. So it was a very structured crowdsourcing, but in a structured fashion. And then in parallel, I began conducting laboratory research at Penn, now in my third and fourth year of medical school.
And you found that, I mean, across the world, samples that were taken, you know, during diagnostic tests were being people who had Castleman's were just being destroyed, and that's an incredibly important piece of the puzzle. How did you address that?
So these samples were many times destroyed, but oftentimes were kept in freezers for decades, and no one was doing any work on them. And everyone had—
But they were still viable?
Some of not the ones that were too old, but there were many that were viable, and folks were not keeping them in their freezer because they had bad intentions. They intended to do research and they intended to use them one day, but unfortunately they were not. And so my effort became, okay, let's identify what needs to be done. Let's get the right people to do it. And then let's go get those samples and let's get them to the right person at the right time and start moving forward the science.
And you included patients in the crowdsourcing too. Why?
That's right. It was critical. So, you know, I found that anytime you involve patients in the process of identifying the right studies and prioritizing research, researchers focus more on what really matters, and that's answers and solutions for patients. They focus a little bit less on who's the first author of the paper will be and more on how can we help this patient who's in the room today, but also because patients have really important suggestions and contributions. There's things that we observe about our disease and things that we want for our future that researchers aren't always in touch with.
Let's get to some comments. Dan says, it's great there are places willing to research cures for these rare diseases, but the cost of this research is astronomical. We need to find a way to better compensate these researchers and eliminate financial toxicity. Again, there was no money in federal funding for Castleman's. What do you say to Dan's comment?
I agree with Dan. Early on, we had to raise money from family and friends, you know, $5 donations, had to add up to about $10,000. Our first study cost about $10,000. And we generated some really important data from our first $10,000 study. And then we used those data to then go raise about $50,000 to do our next study.
And where do you go for this money?
And so literally
still family
friends,
$5 yeah, donations.
Exactly. Literally family and friends. And what I should say is it's Philadelphia family and friends. Yeah. The Philadelphia community has been the foundation of everything that we've done. People all over Philly donating their time, donating financially, donating their ideas to Castleman's research.
Comment from Jacques, who says, I have a rare disease, and the main issue I see is that for people without the medical background of your guest, we're relying on doctors to figure out our illnesses without actually experiencing the symptoms we face. How can people be their own researchers? So there are two things going on there. Again, you know, relying on doctors to figure out illnesses. I mean, it's an imperfect science.
So
where do you go? How do we improve the doctor-patient relationships? Is it being taught? We talked about bedside manner, I think, a few years ago, you know, during a show on medicine and in Radio Times. Is that being taught in medical school now, improving the doctor-patient relationship?
I think there has been a pendulum swing in the way that physicians are educated about the importance of including the patient perspective. But there's work to be done. And so I think that, you know, I would recommend trying to figure out who is the world's expert for your disease. And you know, maybe they're within driving distance. And it's probably worth getting to that person. And as I mentioned, in my case, sometimes the world's expert doesn't actually have the answers because the world doesn't know the answers. Mm-hmm. And that's a really sobering fact for, unfortunately, a lot of diseases.
You were a medical student at the time.
That's right.
So for somebody who's not of the medical world, getting to that person who's at the top of the tier might not be – they may not have the channels to do so. What do you suggest?
Yeah, it's a great point. What I really suggest is trying to figure out the advocacy organization for your particular disease. Nearly all rare diseases have some group, whether it's an umbrella organization or specific for that disease, that you can go to. And usually their main focus is helping to get patients to the right doctors. And so go through them, and they should be able to help you.
I'd like to reintroduce our guest. David Fagenbaum is assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. He is a person who has beat back Castleman's disease 5 times. It is a deadly illness. It's very rare. There was very little research done into it. And his story is about tackling not only, you know, what this disease is, but the research piece of it and working toward finding a treatment and an eventual cure. There, you don't have a cure yet. You have a therapy.
That's
correct?
Exactly right. Yeah. So after my fifth one of these flares, I received chemotherapy again to save my life, a combination of 7 chemotherapies that obliterated my immune system. And I just kind of barely survived again. And after that fifth one, I realized that I could no longer kind of deal with the frequent relapses and remissions, and I was actually approaching the lifetime maximum dosage of the chemotherapy I was getting.
At age what?
I was 27 at the time. And so I then dug into my data. I'd been conducting laboratory research, and I began digging into my data and all my medical records. And after weeks of spending all day, all night trying to identify something, I found a pattern in my data that suggested to me that a particular communication line in the immune system, it's called the mTOR pathway, that communication line seemed to be hyperactive in my samples. And there's a drug. It's called sirolimus. It was developed for kidney transplantation 25 years ago that targets this communication line.
What does it do in targeting it?
So it inhibits this pathway, and in doing so, it turns off immune cells' ability to proliferate and to attack the body. And so it seemed like a rational and potentially helpful option. We didn't know if it would work. It had never been used before in Castleman disease. But we didn't have time to wait and test it out further. So the beginning of 2014, I began myself on sirolimus as the first ever idiopathic multicenter Castleman's disease patient in the world on sirolimus.
So stop for 1 second. So you were able to somehow access this drug, even though it was not for what it was initially intended. How do you get around that in the medical field?
I
guess around the FDA, or do you not have to go around the FDA?
This is a really important concept, and it's called drug repurposing and using drugs off-label. And it's basically anytime a drug gets approved for anything, no matter what the approval is, doctors can write a prescription to use that drug for anything else they want. So even if it's approved for one thing, it can actually be prescribed for anything. The question is whether the insurance companies or the payer will actually pay for that drug. Yeah. When you have a rare disease, and particularly a rare and deadly disease, insurance companies are often more willing to pay for new uses of existing drugs because there are no other options. But we were able to get access to this drug. It's actually a lot cheaper than most of the chemotherapies that I had received. Able to get access to it. And I started the drug and hoped that, you know, this drug could work. It's now been 5.5 years that I've been in remission on this drug, a drug that had never been used or even thought to be used for this disease. And I think that's such an important lesson for us to think broadly beyond Castleman disease. How many drugs? There are about 1,500 drugs already FDA approved for one disease. How many of those drugs might be treatments or cures for the 7,000 diseases that don't have any treatments or cures? And I really, really hope through my book that we'll be able to highlight this potential new way to get answers for patients that don't have any.
It sounds as if there needs to be an organization devoted solely to researching what's out there and how this might be applied elsewhere.
I agree, because there are new tools that exist today that didn't exist even 5 years ago in medical science that we can use to better understand and probe what's wrong in a disease and then be able to say, okay, if we know this is wrong in this disease, of the drugs that we have, is there one of them that can fix this problem, even if it was developed for something totally different 20 years ago?
Do you see yourself getting the ball rolling on that with your hyper-focus, David?
I hope so.
Or your hands must be full right now. You've got a baby at home and you've got a very full career.
That's right.
So with this drug, say the name again.
Sirolimus.
Sirolimus. You're in remission 5 years. Is this, at what point do you consider it to be a legitimate treatment / cure and other Castleman's patients using it?
So we've begun to use it off-label. There are about 10 patients that I'm aware of that have received sirolimus that have my disease, and about half of them that I'm aware of have responded well and half have not. The half that have not have been particularly ill in the intensive care unit when they were treated. So the key now is to move from this kind of anecdotal working in some, not others, to a clinical trial. So just two weeks ago at the University of Pennsylvania, we opened up the first ever clinical trial for treatment refractory Castleman's patients using sirolimus. So we're going to enroll 26 patients over the next year and treat them with this drug and hope that it's a solution for them and really hope that it's a model for many other diseases.
That must make you feel great.
It makes me feel so great.
Yeah.
My book is titled Chasing My Cure, but really it's about chasing our cure. All of us with Castleman disease, this drug hopefully is going to help others, but we do know it doesn't help everyone.
All right. We continue our conversation with David Feigenbaum, the author of Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action, in just a moment here on Radio Times. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moskowain has the day off today. Our guest this hour is David Feigenbaum. He is author of Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. When he was in medical school, he became deathly ill and experienced, near-death experiences, totaled 5 with this illness of his, Castleman's disease. And it turned, he actually turned this experience into an effort to corral, if you will, research, some funding, and the wisdom of physicians, medical experts from across the world into movement toward treatment and an eventual cure of Castleman's. And again, we're not, this particular medication, sirolimus,
that's right,
is not considered a cure as of yet. You're in clinical trials.
That's exactly right. And it's helping me. It's helping some other patients. It's been 5.5 years I've been in remission. But I do know that this disease is relentless and it's unpredictable. And so when I talk about how long I've been in remission, it's been 68.16 months. And the reason that I say that is because I know that I can't round up. I don't know if I'll make it to 69 months that I'll be in remission. I know that this disease could come back at any moment, but I also don't round down because we worked really hard for that 0.16 months.
Earlier, you had described, I think it was the first time you fell ill with Castleman's, and you just had a deep deep-seated feeling of doom.
That's
almost.
Right.
You know, now, though, I'm not getting that sense from you. You're not sure whether the remission's going to last, but you seem as if you have a very, you know, a positive feeling about how things are going in the future.
That's right. I think that I have a tempered optimism, and it's because it's been 5.5 years this drug's been working. It's because in addition to this drug, the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, which I lead here in Philadelphia, has made tremendous progress in better understanding the disease. We haven't figured it out, and we don't know a lot about the disease, but we know a lot more than we did when I first became ill. So I'm optimistic because I know that if and when I do relapse, that we know more about this disease than we did the last time I became ill, and that hopefully there are some other treatments that could maybe help me in that case. I think I also have a newfound optimism because I have this one-year-old daughter, Amelia. My wife and I are so thankful that we were able to have Amelia a year ago, and she's brought so much joy into our lives and also given me for the first time, I look beyond just my next infusion next month, you know, a month from now. I start thinking about the future.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to Caitlin, because I think when we last left you two in the story, you had been reluctant to let her see you when you were deathly ill. You eventually relented, and that led to eventually a marriage proposal.
That's right.
But literally, I think you had yet another bout with this illness just a few months before the wedding.
That's right. So the fifth flare and the fifth time I nearly died was just a few months before we got married. And for me, I didn't think I would survive any of the five near-death episodes. No one did. My doctors and my family did not either. And with that fifth one, I was so devastated that I wouldn't make it to May 2014, that I wouldn't make it to our wedding date. It wasn't that I was thinking, you know, I'm not going to have this long life with Caitlin, because I didn't think that I was going to have a long life with Caitlin. I just really wanted to make it to our wedding day, and I was devastated that I wouldn't be able to. But fortunately, I just barely made it out of that episode, and I was able to make it to our wedding day. And actually, my hair grew back just in time for our wedding day, so I had about half inch long hair, and so It looked to anyone who didn't know what I'd gone through like maybe I just had a short haircut and that I hadn't just gone through multi-agent chemo.
Well, there's a picture of you two on your wedding day.
That's
in
right.
The book, and you both look fabulous.
Thank
and
you.
I should mention, too, that we are going to go offer up a slideshow of some of the pictures from your book. So if anybody wants to take a look, it's at whyy.org/radiotimes. We've got an email from Kira who says, I am also a rare disease patient. I have aplastic anemia, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Mm-hmm. About 900 people in the U.S. are diagnosed with it per year. One doctor, Dr. Neil Young at NIH, decided to take on finding cures for it. I really want to commend you for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
One doctor really can make a difference for thousands of patients by taking on a rare disease.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for sharing that. I totally agree with you. I think that, before I joined the medical community, and now I'm a physician scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, as we said earlier, I just kind of expected and hoped that the right work was being done by the right people and that there was kind of this machine behind medical research. But what I've learned is that there is not a machine. There are just a bunch of really hardworking people who dedicate their lives to treatments and cures. And those of us that are dedicating our lives to treatments and cures, we can't just hope someone else somewhere we'll do it. We have to turn our hope into action.
Yeah. Well, some of the researchers, the people who work on rare diseases or any diseases for that matter, sometimes do things which are literally heroic. They try the remedies on themselves before administering them to human patients as part of their research. Tell us about Dr. Kazu Yoshizaki?
That's right.
All right. So what did he do? He was one of these people who you found.
That's right.
Who had been looking into Castleman's. Tell us about how he helped the effort.
So in the late 80s, he was really the lead expert in the Castleman's disease field. He made a really seminal discovery that has subsequently led to an FDA-approved drug for Castleman's. It doesn't work for me, but it works for a large portion of patients. And in Kazu's journey to develop this drug, he developed a mouse model, and he was treating the mice, and the mice were getting better. And when it was time to give it to humans, he was worried about how humans would be able to tolerate it.
And this is all happening in Japan?
This is all happening in Japan. Mm-hmm. The way the story goes, I had heard that he had given the drug to himself to prove that it worked. And so I saw Kazu recently, and I asked him, I said, Kazu, I heard that you gave tocilizumab to yourself to prove that it was safe in humans. And he said, no, I didn't give it to myself. The nurse, she gave it to me. I said, exactly, Kazu.
Okay, sure.
Exactly. And so, yeah, he gave it to himself, and he didn't die, which was his concern, and he survived. So they were able to move it on to giving it to other humans. It went on to get approved in Japan for Castleman disease, and amazingly, it got approved in the United States several years later for rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. And that drug, tocilizumab, is actually the drug that saved Emily Whitehead, the young patient here in Philadelphia's life when she was treated with CART-19 therapy. And by saving her life, it helped to keep the life of CART therapy here in Philadelphia. And it's amazing to track back that that drug, tocilizumab, would never have been available had not been for Kazuo Yoshizaki first testing it on himself and now it being available worldwide.
Boy, yeah, that is amazing. We had Dr. Stephen Grupp on a couple of years ago, and he told us about Emily's story. She had leukemia. She was at death's door. They tried the CAR-T, but her body had such an enormous reaction that almost put her over the edge. For this drug.
For tocilizumab, exactly.
So when Dr. Yoshizaki did this, I mean, what was the risk to himself? And could you do that here in the United States?
I don't think you probably should do that anywhere.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I don't think you should, you know, give a drug that had never been given to humans to yourself. I think that there were a lot of risks. This was back in the days before we knew that this type of a drug called a monoclonal antibody was somewhat safe. And so he took a major risk by giving it to himself. But I think it reflects the kind of motivations and hard work that so many of us in the research field have, that we're literally willing to risk it all to identify treatments to save patients' lives.
Well, you tried the sirolimus on yourself, but that had already been approved for a different usage in this country. So
that's
right. There were risks.
Exactly. We knew it had been given to other people for 25 years, and we knew that there was, you know, known side effects of the drug. We didn't know what it would do to someone with Castleman disease. Our immune system gets out of control and, as you know, attacks vital organs. So we didn't know if somehow could sirolimus, you know, trigger a relapse. Could it somehow make things worse? But fortunately, it did not.
During your treatments, you had this thought, David, and this is from your book. Maybe all of us doctors should have some of these procedures done on us a couple of times during medical school so we can understand what they're like.
That's right.
Probably not going to happen.
That's right. There were a few procedures that I had done dozens of times as a medical student and hadn't really thought twice, that when I had them done as a patient and I understood the pain or the discomfort, I thought to myself, man, I wish that I had known this when I was a medical student.
How do you promote that sense of empathy without actually, you know, having a procedure performed on yourself that's unnecessary?
I think it's I think that it's encouraging physicians to listen to your patients more, which is happening more in medical education. I think it's also reading books like Chasing My Cure and getting insights from other patients out there that can tell you, you know, what was actually going through their head when these procedures were done.
Also, you write of humor in your book. It's not all, you know, a dark and yet hopeful tale. For instance, you write, for every doctor, there is a first procedure or a first event. You tell of your time as a young man on an obstetrics rotation about to deliver a baby. And I think you were probably in your mid-20s. The parents-to-be were in their late 20s,
That's right.
something like that, older than you were. And the father asks you, this isn't your first time, is it?
And I said, no, it's not, but it was my second time.
And at the first sign of the baby's head, your thought was?
Don't drop it, Dave.
So again, where can humor, help in all areas of life? And, you know, I know we addressed this a little bit earlier, but it comes back to the fact that you experienced so many dark moments. You're such a young man to have gone through this five times. Can it actually help in healing?
Yes, I think.
And how do you think?
I think humor is so important in the midst of tough times. You'd think that, you know, dying in the hospital, the last thing you would want to do is laugh. But actually, that was the thing that we needed to do the most. It brought my family together.
You were able to laugh at the worst moments as a family in the ICU?
Yeah, one example. So when I was in the ICU, there wasn't too much laughter because I was unconscious. But when I would start to improve, that was kind of when we would be able to kind of go back to our old ways. And one example was when I was hospitalized for the third time and nearly died again. And we went for a walk. It was New Year's Eve of 2010. Went for a walk around the hematology oncology floor. And New Year's Eve evening, we passed a gentleman who'd been clearly drinking on New Year's Eve. He was kind of swaying in his chair. And on our next lap around, we saw that he'd fallen to the floor. And so my dad ran over to him and helped him back into his chair. And he looked at my dad and I, and he said, "Thanks so much. Good luck to you and your wife." And we said, "Wife, what's he talking about?" And at the time, I mentioned I had fluid all over my body. So I had about 5 liters of fluid in my belly. So I looked like a pregnant woman.
You were a few months along.
And yeah. So this guy thought that my dad and I were getting ready to deliver our child, and that I was walking with this IV pole to deliver our baby, which
could have gone either way.
It could have gone either way. And it could have been a really low point. But I turned to my dad and said, "Man, you've got an ugly wife." And we laughed so hard. And I think in the midst of these really tough times, it's so important to find humor and something to laugh about.
Your dad is an orthopedic surgeon.
He is.
He set a lot aside so that he could be with you. He was there every step of the way.
He was. So when I was finally discharged after almost 6 months hospitalized, I remember the nurse saying, "You know, are you happy to be out?" I said, "Yes, I can't wait. I've been in the hospital for 6 months." And he said, "What is this? I've been in the hospital for 6 months. We've been in the hospital for 6 months." And he was absolutely right. He was there through everything.
So David Fagenbaum, where is Castleman's research today? Is it where you want it to be?
It's not where I want it to be. We've made a lot of progress, and I'm really happy with the progress we've made, as I mentioned before, thanks to donations from Philadelphians and time donated from Philadelphians. But we have a long way still to go. We're starting to understand how the immune system works, and we're also starting to understand how the immune system works in other diseases based on what we're learning from Castleman disease. And so I want us to continue to push that forward at the University of Pennsylvania, where my lab is, but also with researchers around the world for Castleman disease. And we would love continued support for the work that we're doing. But no, unfortunately, we're not where I want to be today. But with continued work, I think we can get to where we need to be.
Where do you think you'll be in 5 years? Do you think there will be a cure?
I really hope there will be a cure. Yeah. And of course, my book is all about turning hope into action.
Sure.
So I can promise you after this show, I'm going to rush back to the lab and try to turn my hope into action.
So let's get back to funding and also the layperson. We had a number of folks who reached out to us during this hour who talked about their own experience with rare illness. Getting started using the internet to help raise awareness and funding. Give us a step-by-step as to how you do that.
Absolutely. So, you know, I was a medical student at the time. I'm now a physician scientist. So it might seem that the things that I did were things that maybe you have to have a medical degree to do. But the reality is that some of the most important progress that we made is based on the fact that we brought a community together. That was just sending a bunch of emails. We build a discussion board for them to communicate with one another. We organized a meeting for doctors to come together to talk with one another. These are things that anyone can do, things that are so critical to organize a field and to push things forward.
Mm-hmm. And what does it take? What would the initial message be, you know, online? I mean, what do you do first?
Yeah, so the first step would be we want to find out everyone who's researching and treating X disease.
Okay.
Because we want to get you together so you can help us to identify the right research questions to ask and the right studies to do to help to cure it.
Yeah. Are you hearing from people who have Castleman disease?
We are.
Around the world?
We are. Castleman's patients from all over the world are part of our network. And it's so exciting to hear about how the drugs that we're developing and pushing forward, how they're helping patients today. But we also receive the sobering news when patients don't survive and despite the best therapies that they don't work. And so we continue to push forward with everything we have. And, you know, when I think about why I wrote this book, it wasn't just to share the Castleman disease story, though that is very important. It's also to share some of these really important life lessons that I learned about life from nearly dying for anyone and everyone, whether you have a disease, a rare disease, or a loved one with a disease. It's really about, in the midst of really tough times, how can you get up and fight back in the midst of life's most challenging moments?
So moving forward, David, how do you view life?
I view life through the lens of this concept that I call overtime, and that's that when I almost died for the first time and had my last rites read to me, I consider that to be the start of my first overtime. In overtime, every second counts. You know, you can make a mistake in the beginning of a game and you can make up for it, but in overtime, every second really has to count. And so I live with the sense that we're all in overtime and that we need to make the most of every moment. And so I do that when I'm with my daughter, Amelia, when I'm with my wife, Caitlin, when I'm working in the lab, I'm always thinking, how can I make the most of this time?
Yeah. With joy?
With lots of joy.
All right. David Feigenbaum, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times. It was a pleasure.
Best of luck to you.
And again, we've put together a slideshow of some of the pictures from David's book, which is called Chasing My Cure, A Doctor's Race to Turn Hope into Action. You can find those pictures at whyy.org/Radio Times. And David, you are going to be in 1 week next Tuesday at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia.
That's right, with Angela Duckworth.
That's right, for a question and answer session and a signing and all that good stuff. So that's next Tuesday, September 17th at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. So it was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Our engineer today is Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks, as always, for listening to Radio Times.